From RunAsRadio.com, you're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell. This is Brandon Wen announcing show number 256 with guest Brent Ozar, recorded Monday, February 13th, 2012. Run As Radio is produced each week by Quap Productions, providing professional media and podcasting services online at pwop.com. You can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/runasradio.
Thank you, Brandon. This is Richard Campbell. You are listening to Run As Radio. My guest today is the one, the only, Brent Ozar, one of the first Microsoft certified masters I ever spoke to. I think we did a show on it way back when.
That's
still
right.
A SQL Server MVP?
I am. I absolutely love it.
Those guys haven't caught on to you yet, huh?
No, I know. I keep saying all kinds of nasty things about Microsoft, and they keep looking the other way. I love those guys.
Strangest thing. And, of course, your site is BrentOzar.com. You've been doing this a long time.
Yeah.
Wrote the book, Professional SQL Server 2008, Internals and Troubleshooting. And is that enough for you for books, or are you going to update it for 2012?
Man, I'm done. I'll do ebooks, but it'll only be short stuff.
Yeah.
Writing a book is hard.
It's hard work. And it's one of those things, like if you do more than one, you're just not learning.
Well, yeah, I don't get it. I have nothing but respect for people, especially the ones who can pull off a book start to finish with just them and nobody else.
Yeah.
No co-authors. Wow. I'm like, your wife must either really hate you, or, you know, she's waiting by the door feeding you, you know, every time you get out.
I have met folks that are simply obsessive writers, that their idea of a conversation ends up being 800 pages.
Oh, man, yeah. I mean, I have a lot of things I'd like to say on a topic, but I'd rather do it with a human being on the other side of the, you know, room with me than,
sure,
than trying to write it out. Ooh, you always wonder if the person on the other end of the page is getting it or not.
Yeah. It's a long way down the path. Talk to me about the Certified Master Program. You were, I think, one of the first early on, and really an arduous class, as I recall. We did a whole show on that.
Yeah, that was used to be a 3-week-long process on-site at Microsoft.
Yeah.
They've changed some of them. Some programs are still that on-site deal, mm-hmm, but the SQL Server one isn't. Now, for those of you who are a glutton for punishment, you can study on your own and then go take a written exam for about $500. And then if you pass that, around 90 days later, you go get to take the same kind of lab that I took, a 6-hour monster lab. You walk out of there crying and swearing you're never going to do that again, much like writing a book.
Nice.
And it's been good because we really believed that there were a lot of what we called uncertified masters out there.
Right.
People who knew their stuff but couldn't afford to be down for 3 weeks on-site at Microsoft to prove it.
Yeah, anybody that good at SQL Server is too busy to take that
course.
Yeah,
they're already out working, and we've seen that, thankfully. There was a bit of a spin-up time as the new exam started to get out there and people started feeling more confident, because, you know, the downside of this is that you do actually have to study yourself at that point. But we've started seeing more and more people cross the finishing line.
We had
great guy, Gavin, out of the UK, Gavin Payne, and then Argenis Fernandez out of Seattle area, former South Floridian, both passed in the last couple of weeks. Denny Cherry, Sean McCown. There's been several members of the community, and I think it really does good for the community to see that, oh, you know, there are people out there who I've seen them blog, I've seen them speak,
mm-hmm,
and they're able to pass too. So mm-hmm, that's been a good feeling.
Microsoft recognized them as the experts they are.
Yeah, yeah. And I get into trouble when I say this, but a lot of people think that the MVP program recognizes technical accuracy, and that's not necessarily the case.
No.
It has to do with community activity and rewarding people for giving back to the community. But there's this just insanely high bar for certified masters, and it's great to see that starting to trickle out now.
Well, and I think it's one of the challenges of our industry is actually proving you know what you know.
Yeah, yeah. Over and over again, I walk into client gigs and, you know, people will say, okay, how can you prove to me that what we're about to do isn't going to take my server down?
Yeah.
You know, so it really helps to say, all right, there's, you know, a dozen of us in the U.S. who are certified masters who don't work for Microsoft. You know, we really put in our time and we know what we're doing and we're professionally liable when things go wrong.
Yeah. Well, and interesting that I really think the liability is the big thing. You talk about professional organizations like lawyers and engineers and doctors and so forth. It is that liability element that is important, that the certification body is liable.
Business-ending events. Nobody calls me when they're having a good time.
No. No, I never get the easy calls. I only get the hard calls.
Yeah, yeah. It's all about, you know, by the time somebody calls a certified master, they've gone through either other consultants or it's been puzzling their staff for months.
Yeah.
So we get the stuff that's just horrendously difficult. And it's the best feeling in the world to, I was working with a client last week, and within the first 8 hours, I said, all right, here's, this is where your problem is. Made these three changes. We could make them during business hours. And immediately their website started running faster. Orders processed again. You know, it was one of those where it was just this big eureka light went on. I said, why didn't we call you earlier?
Yeah.
So, but you just don't always need that. I mean, not everybody needs that certified master, you know, level of experience. So.
Yeah, it's not always a firefight, hopefully, anyway.
Yeah, yeah. Sooner or later, you have the regular day job kind of stuff. So it's been a lot of fun. And getting to see other people progress through the program. I'm looking forward to going to Connections this month, and, or next month, I guess, now. It's
We're recording in February, but it'll probably be published in March. So about the time the show comes out is shortly before Connections.
Yeah, so I'm really excited about that.
Is that going to be the launch for 2012? It's going to be right around then.
Boy, it's tricky how Microsoft is wording this. They've got several things going on that they're calling launch events.
Yeah.
Connections is one of them, SQL Bits in the UK. They're having a special ops tour where they're going city to city throughout March and showing people, you know, demos and features and getting people excited about the new features, but I don't know when we're going to actually see the code. That's the part that's kind of frustrating. Mm-hmm. They're getting us all excited up, chomping at the bit for especially things like availability groups, the ability to now offload reads across multiple servers or do backups on a secondary server, stuff that we've always wanted. And so everybody's getting excited about that particular release.
Which is interesting because I thought we pretty much had a mature product here.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and if you look at the number of people who are still running SQL 2000 or 2005, pretty high. I mean, this stuff works. It works good enough. It's like the cockroaches after, you know, nuclear war. I get the feeling that after a nuclear war, we're going to pull a closet back somewhere and there's going to be a running SQL Server 2000 instance buried in there. Because it works pretty well. It's now the 2012 stuff really feels like it's tackling some of the scale-out things that people wanted to go to the cloud for. But it's interesting to see how Microsoft does its bets, you know, with between SQL Azure and between some of the scale-out stuff in 2012. Now, I think the last time we talked, it was still some of the same kind of dichotomy. There's half the people are going to the cloud for that scale, and half of the people, not half by any means, I mean, that's a high number, but some of the audience is going towards the cloud, and some of them are going towards the El Cheapo solid-state stuff that really makes it easy to scale out these days.
Yeah, and the general SSDs, have you played with the Fusion IO product?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Now, there's some serious speed and pretty high-quality gear.
Yeah, but them and OCZ's starting to nip at their tails now. OCZ's gotten even faster PCI Express drives. And I just love how it makes so many problems disappear.
Yeah.
You plug these things in and, oh, you know, you were having contention problems. That's gone now.
You always can tune your way out of things to some degree, but you can't argue with the cost effectiveness of fast hardware.
And there's no code change risk. You know, I'll recommend people make certain changes, but there's still a risk that the results that come out of a stored proc might be different or sorting might be different or whatever it is. I mean, you just drop in the solid state stuff, and so often it makes, you know, tuning problems disappear. It's and it even makes server purchasing different. We were just with a client yesterday deciding what servers they wanted to buy. And now it matters how many PCI Express slots you have in the server. It suddenly becomes a really big deal. Even more so than, you know, the number of drive bays. People used to look at, oh, I need, you know, 18 drive bays built in plus a, you know, dedicated attached storage. Well, no, how about we look at, say, you know, two PCI Express slots and we do a mirrored pair of Fusion IOs or a mirrored pair of OCZs. And we offload some of the stuff to attach SATA, but, you know, the rest of it's just living on that solid state, and it's just insanely fast.
Yeah. Throw that tempDB in there. Watch it go. The problems just go away.
Yeah. I do. You know, don't you want to let your end users do reporting in production? You know, write their own wacko queries.
Yeah.
Aren't you tired of troubleshooting deadlocks and locking issues? And even though memory is cheap, memory's gotten pretty cheap at least.
Yeah.
Still doesn't hurt to have some screaming fast storage in there.
Well, and I still run out of memory. I don't seem to run out of storage.
Yeah. Well, and there's some things SQL Server just won't use all your memory for.
Yeah.
You know, if you do a big join between a couple of tables, SQL Server is very quickly going to start writing your results to TempDB instead of doing it in memory. And it makes sense because you're going to have a lot of people fighting over the same memory. But, yeah, it's sooner or later you're going to have to hit the disk, and that's where storage matters.
Yeah. Just this mindset of, imagine if hitting the disk wasn't a disaster.
Yes. But you didn't start crying when you ran out of memory every time. Yeah. And we did Stack Overflow. We just ran into that, too. We started finally hitting the points where we couldn't fit the entire database in memory. That used to be our easy silver bullet for scaling. We just, you know, use commodity hardware and stash the whole thing in memory. But people seem to love the site, so it's grown up in volume and now moving on to a bigger set of SSDs. And I want to say we're at 288 gigs of memory now.
Wow.
But you can do, I mean, people say, wow, or why wouldn't you go to NoSQL or scale out?
Yeah.
But it's pretty cheap. I mean, it's not that expensive anymore to throw, you know, a quarter terabyte of memory in a server.
Yeah, it really isn't. And licenses still cost money, but you know, the Hadoop / RavenDB / pick your NoSQL poison, they've got some impressive numbers too.
Oh, yeah. Especially where if you seriously need CPU power, it makes sense to get that out of SQL Server as fast as you can.
Sure.
Given the licensing changes coming down the pike in 2012 that nobody's happy about, but we're all going to have to deal with. So now, starting in 2012, SQL Server is licensed by the core, not by the socket. So we start to get penalized. Yeah. So basically, there's a cost increase if you're putting more than quad cores in. So if you're using 8-core processors, you're looking at double the licensing cost. 10-core processors, you know, 150% extra. It's roughly for Enterprise Edition, we're looking at about $7,000 a core. And that's an eye-opening number, but it just reinforces why you shouldn't be doing CPU-intensive stuff in the database anyway.
Sure. But it also gets back to, you knew the socket thing wasn't going to last.
That
was a temporary measure. It was obvious to me. And too many people are installing Enterprise that don't actually need Enterprise. The only thing that drives people to standard is having to actually pay for Enterprise.
There's a couple of limitations on standard that are, they kind of bum me out for 2012.
Mm-hmm.
So for 2008 and 2008 R2, standard edition was capped at 64 gigs of RAM, which sounded like a lot at the time.
Yeah.
But today
it's not that
much. And in 2012, unfortunately, that cap remains in the same place.
No.
Yeah, to go, if you want to use more than 64 gigs of RAM, you have to go to Enterprise Edition.
Yeah, somebody needs to shake their head. 4 years later, 64 gigs of RAM is not a lot of money. It's a minor thing.
No, not when I'm looking at picking up a new Mac Pro before they cycle the hardware.
Yeah.
It's 32 gigs of RAM in a desktop, let alone, you know, what you put in a server. So, that kind of gets me a little nervous there. And then the cool always-on availability group stuff, which is our ability to take backups on a secondary machine, our ability to fail over to lots of different machines. That's also Enterprise Edition only as well. So, yeah, they seem to hold out some of the really good stuff for Enterprise Edition.
Interesting. But, I mean, to me now it starts to sound like Standard is almost Express.
Yeah. Standard is the new Express.
Yeah.
Kind of funny how that works. And it's because of its limits, too. I mean, I want to say, if I remember right, it's 16 cores is the max as well with Standard.
Mm-hmm.
So you bump into some of those limits pretty quickly.
And so get back to your original premise here, which is if you've got computational challenges, you should be not doing them in SQL Server.
Yeah, the database is a great place to store your data. It's not such a great place to use an application server or any kind of CPU-intensive work, which we've been preaching.
We've had .NET stash inside a SQL Server for a while.
Yeah, which thank goodness it never really caught on.
No, it didn't. I mean, there were very specific technical problems, you know, the actuarial problem where I have massive amounts of data and I have computational challenges that it made sense to do those things together. But I would think today you just go to the NoSQL solution.
Yeah, or absolutely, or farm it out somehow. Mm-hmm. However, whether you want to do it in the .NET stack, you know, I've got people just grabbing out parts of the data and then doing lots of crunching individually, or you really go hardcore with Hadoop. And if you want to take the Microsoft approach, Microsoft's even embracing Hadoop with SQL Server now.
Right.
So, you know, they see where there's money to be made, and they're all over it.
So, I mean, there's Hadoop in Azure. What's the relationship between Hadoop and SQL Server?
Well, so this is interesting. I'll give you an example out of one of the clients that I work with. When you sue someone, now heaven forbid you ever have to, but if you sue someone, say that you sue some giant global corporation and your lawyers, as a part of that, get a whole bunch of data for discovery. They get copies of everyone's hard drives, everyone's email, all the file servers. It was a tremendous amount of data. And while we might bring all of the metadata internally and work with it in SQL Server, we need to throw all the flat files out somewhere, and then we need to do a lot of crunching on those flat files to figure out which ones are interesting. But then we want to put that transactional information about which ones we find interesting and which ones we want to process, our human beings to process first. We want that to still live in SQL Server.
Right.
It makes sense to have an on-premise SQL Server that's fairly large, may still be in the multiple terabyte range, but we'll do a lot of crunching out in Hadoop, out across whether it's in Windows Azure or whether it's in, you know, on-premise hordes of machines. But the cloud makes a lot of sense for that because your lawsuit isn't going to last forever. It's going to be just this big purge or binge of data as it all comes in, and then you're done for a while.
Yeah, and electronic discovery is a whole thing unto itself. So Microsoft, in their infinite wisdom, has built a connector to Hadoop for SQL Server.
Yes, yes.
Interesting.
Now, of course, now the challenge is, what are any of us going to do with Hadoop? This is the not the area of expertise for database administrators or for traditional .NET developers. But if you want to get into big data, that's the place to be. It's going to be on fire over the next, or continue to be on fire for the next 12 to 18 months.
Well, and putting on my dev hat, over in .NET Rocks, we've had the conversation a few times about how it makes sense to use NoSQL data stores inside of your application, but to propagate that data into a relational database, typically SQL Server, to do your reporting on, because you have all these great tools, but they really expect a relational database.
Absolutely. And you have all these interfaces, things that are already built to go back and forth to your enterprise systems, your accounting systems, your human resources systems, your inventory, and all of that expects stuff to be in a relational database.
Sure.
So in it goes. And we're really good at things like transactional backups. You know, that works well.
Well, I also really appreciate the idea. It's certainly something I've done when setting up the OLTP and reporting server is organizing your data for better reporting rather than for transactional velocity on the reporting side.
Absolutely. And that, again, too, all comes back to SSDs, too. So often now people want to do reporting live in production. They don't want to change any schemas. They want to get instant, up-to-the-minute data. And that's doable in SQL Server. It just gets much more tricky when we start pushing it out into NoSQL, how we build reporting tools to handle that.
Well, and that latency of the push between your NoSQL store and your relational store.
Yeah, becomes important.
Do you see 2012 pushing on this much, this idea? Maybe not in this version, but the next version of working more closely with NoSQL?
I don't. I don't see that coming at all. I bet this is just me putting on my guesstimation hat. Mm-hmm. I bet if Microsoft was going to do that much integration with NoSQL, they'd be wise to do it in the cloud. They'd be wise to do it in SQL Azure. Because if you're going to attack the kind of organizations that change dramatically, that embrace new products and features, and have the need for short, burstable needs of big data, I think that's more of SQL Azure's specialty.
Right.
Whereas the predictable size of data, things that we are going to know are going to be relatively the same for a long period of time, makes sense to do them on-premise. We can usually do them cheaper that way. And I don't know that NoSQL plays well in that arena. Now, on the flip side, you take Stack Overflow as another example there. There are things that we do, full text search, for example. SQL Server full text search is great, but it's CPU intensive, and there comes the licensing thing again. So there, it makes sense to move things out into a NoSQL area where it's much better at handling text documents and looking up key value pairs.
Sure. Yeah, and it's, if the store's not there, just don't worry about it.
Yeah, life goes on. Absolutely.
This section of Run As Radio is sponsored by Secret Server, the password management software for IT admins. Secret Server helps you manage local admin passwords and service accounts the right way. Get your free 30-day trial for Secret Server at runasradio.com/secretserver. So The other thing that blew my mind around 2012 that sort of surprised me is this idea of storing your databases in a NAS.
Unbelievable. It was...
That's like on my list of really bad ideas.
I, as a former SAN administrator, I go, it's you can't get better performance than you get in a SAN.
Yeah.
If it's configured correctly, it's more reliable than anything else. Why on earth would I want to use some cheap $500 NAS and put my databases on there when databases are arguably the most important things in the business?
Mm-hmm.
Well, as it turns out, people are making a lot of bad infrastructure decisions. People are doing things like 1 gig iSCSI with virtualization, where they know performance is going to be bad, but it's cheap and they're okay with that.
Right.
In those kinds of environments, it makes a lot of sense to go ahead and put your databases on a network share, make them very easy to back up, make them easy to move from one SQL server to another. So now when you attach a database, you could be literally attaching it from a network file share. This is some pretty crazy stuff.
Yeah.
And it has a lot of risks. I mean, this is the same network where we're dragging and dropping files across, where, you know, we're running BitTorrent and all these other things are happening inside there. That gets a little sketchy. But the other saving grace there is the 10 gig iSCSI is really starting to catch, or 10 gig networking period,
right,
is really starting to catch on. And that makes a lot of the SMB performance problems go away. Between that and the improvements that Microsoft put into SMB2, I think we can safely say that it's not going to be the most performant solution, but it's probably not going to be the dumbest decision we make all day as database
administrators. But yeah, I just got to think, if you've got 10 gig Ethernet going on, you're probably not using it to connect to a NAS. I'm trying to imagine a 10 gig NAS.
No, but I mean, you look at big SANs, like you take an EMC or a NetApp,
yeah,
that will connect to 10 gigs and throw a SIF share onto that. Suddenly, maybe it does start to make a little bit of sense.
Yeah, not too crazy.
Yeah, I don't think it's the brightest thing, but it's at the same time, if it really buys you flexibility. A great example is very often I'll do production backups, and mm-hmm, I do them to a network file share because that's the safest place to get them off my SQL server.
Right.
They're stored locally. I'm screwed when the box goes down. But if I do my backups to a remote target, and then I go and restore those also to a remote target somewhere, I could let any developer attach that database from their workstation,
yeah,
and run queries against it.
It'll just work.
That suddenly is awesome.
Yeah, and it's an interesting, and it's a much cheaper than setting up iSCSI targets and
yeah,
all those sorts of things. So, I mean,
yeah,
do you call this a disaster recovery strategy?
So I would only under one circumstance, if I'm doing SAN replication or if I'm doing some kind of NAS replication, mm-hmm, to get that offsite, then I would be kind of okay with it because, mm-hmm, I could quickly attach that database from anything else at the alternate data center. I don't have to worry about SAN connectivity. I can just spin up any virtual machine and have it install SQL Server on it and attach that database from the file share. It wouldn't be my first preference.
Right.
But, hey, you know how disasters work. In any port in a storm.
Yeah,
sometimes,
yeah,
you're just, yeah, really happy to have that database online no matter what.
Yeah, I'm just trying to – so you have sort of a recovery strategy. It's quicker to stand it up on a NAS than it is to try and reconfigure a cluster or, you know,
yeah,
figure out a mirror.
Take another one. Let's say that you're going to get ready to upgrade from SQL 2008 to 2012,
right,
from 2012 to whatever's next. Imagine shutting down your SQL server, then taking a snapshot of wherever that file share is.
Mm-hmm.
So if it's on a NAS, most NASs have the ability to take snapshot backups or just copy the file, and the whole, yeah, copy happens inside the NAS. Upgrade SQL Server, attach the files. If all hell breaks loose, that's okay. You still have an original, you know, 2008 version of the database instead of having to restore from backup.
Yeah.
So there's some edge areas. Utility databases is another one. If there's several people in a reporting team that all want to work on the same database, but we may try and use different servers for it based on capacity or load, it might make sense there because we can easily move it from one database server to another without copying the ginormous file around. But it's interesting. Hopefully it won't be anybody's default as a first choice.
Yeah.
I hope. But hey, I mean, it gives us a whole lot more flexibility than we had before. So that was available in 2008 R2. I just don't think it's really going to start being more adopted until 2012, especially with Windows 8. We'll have additional SMB performance improvements as well, so it makes it even more of a a safe bet. Well, I don't want to say a good bet.
We saw that demo at Build where Server 8 was being run to doing large-scale file transfers, and they just kept adding in NIC connections, and it kept bonding them and increasing the speed.
Yeah, yeah. And imagine, too, now throw 10 gig into the mix. And
sure.
Yeah, suddenly this just doesn't seem like that risky of an idea. And I tell you what, for a home lab, it's fantastic.
Sure.
I'm constantly, as a consultant, I'm constantly restoring people's databases and copying backups around. I just love having a NAS at home that from any machine in my house, I can attach databases onto it and start doing my work. Hmm. That's just wonderful.
So yeah, the lab scenario, all this relatively few connections, it sort of makes sense. These are secondary utilizations rather than the primary utilization.
Yeah, and your primary utilization, the fan-connected stuff, direct attached storage with your Fusion I/O or OCZ or Intel solid-state drives, that all still works. It's not going away. It works better than it ever has.
Mm-hmm.
But it just gives us a new way to access our databases. So it's funny. I mean, the SQL Server just keeps gradually sprawling out and getting bigger and bigger and more capabilities. And then on the other side is we have this new file table functionality. We can turn any SQL Server into a file server. And as you drag and drop files into there, go straight into a SQL Server database. You don't have to know anything about SQL Server. This, in theory, is really good for those file upload scenarios.
Right.
Yeah.
But they're not blobbing them either.
Yes. They are being blobbed behind the scenes.
Okay.
Yeah, so they are going to go into the transaction log. But that, hey, it's on the bright side there, though, is that if we're using the 2012 availability groups, now that blob and the files can be immediately available over somewhere else, like in my disaster recovery data center.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of useful. I don't know how widespread that'll be. I'm still not a big fan of putting binaries in the database. And then you can do funny stuff like run an update statement and change a file name, so which is always kind of funny.
Yeah,
fun for demo tricks.
Yeah, wasn't it 2008 that really introduced this idea of external file storage but still associated with a transaction, the reference to it in the table?
Yeah, FileStream was the first version of it, which I always got the feeling they were kind of doing for SharePoint. FileTable seems like it's an even better solution.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Again, I'm never wild about putting files in the database, but then I'm also never wild about putting databases on a NAS, and it just gives us more cool options of stuff we can do. More ways to solve problems.
Yeah, blobs make me uncomfortable. I don't like an MDB that has a bunch of images in it. But I'm okay with this idea of here's this file stream of an image. You can store it on the disk separately, but make it part of the transaction so it rolls back properly and has its relationships set up. And, those are all good things.
Well, it's kind of tricky, though. There's some gotchas with that.
Mm-hmm.
One of my favorite tricks to do is with a file stream implementation is that it's just files that you can access. If you copy-paste the name, and the names are these weird long GUIDs.
Yeah.
If you copy the name, delete the file, create a new text file with that same name, SQL Server has no idea anything is broken.
Right.
You can do DBCCs, you can do anything you want. SQL Server just thinks, yep, everything's still good.
It's just a name.
Yep, nothing to see here. So I get a little nervous if I'm storing financial transactions, healthcare data, that kind of stuff makes me a little sketchy. I want some audit trails there, and I think FileTable gets us a lot closer to that.
Yeah, it's certainly heading in the right direction. If it's going to be part of a transaction, make it really part of the transaction.
Yeah. Give me some auditing controls, just like I've got now with SQL Server 2008, really improved auditing, and I see more people starting to adopt some of that.
Well, it didn't need to be that complex, just a CRC. So if anything altered on that file, at least, and let's make it optimistic. Don't protect the file, but let me know when the file's been altered.
Give me a ballpark date and time. I don't need to go track down who did it, but know me that there's something that's gone wrong. And what is it they say? Something smells in Denmark? Something's rotten in Denmark?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Just let me know that there's something up. I'll figure out what it is later. But if I never know something's up, then how could I possibly react?
Yeah. So I'm looking forward to seeing both the 2012 launch events that are coming in March that are coming all over the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
and at Connections at the launch event there. To see, get a real release date for this thing and know when we're going to be able to get our hands on the bits. That's the thing I'm most looking forward to, getting the final code. Although clients still have this nasty thing where they say not until Service Pack 1, but.
They're still hanging on to that. Well, and then, like you said earlier on, if I've got an app that's running fine and it's not being upgraded, why would I touch the database it's running on? I'll keep my 2000 or 2005 running on it because it works. It's
yeah,
safe.
Yeah, the cockroaches, it'll be running around there till the end of time. Yeah, it's you know, frustrating as a database administrator. You want to be able to play with all the cool new toys. And I have plenty of people who are frustrated because they're still running 2000. But if the stuff works, you know, it's hard to argue with that.
Well, so, I mean, I can buy into the argument of not upgrading, but certainly you insist that stuff stay patched.
Yeah, yeah.
So you could stay on 2000 as long as it's at SP3 with everything on it.
Yeah. It's fun. It ties in. There's an interesting tie-in there with the MCM program as well. Now, there's a change with the MCM program that your MCM will expire when general support of a product expires.
Interesting.
Which makes sense. I mean, you don't want somebody claiming that they're an MCM forever when the product has given up and moved on. So, of course, there won't be brand new exams the day 2012 comes out because it takes time to establish really good best practices.
Right.
Wouldn't be surprised if it was another year before the 2012 final exams actually started coming out. So if you're thinking about becoming a SQL Server Microsoft Certified Master, now is a really good time. While 2008 is still out, it's still well-supported, you've been doing it for a while, it's been out for, you know, 4 years now, go for the Microsoft Certified Master and you'll still have plenty of time because it's going to last. Your 2008 R2 MCM will last as long as 2008 R2 is under general support.
So right. So it's not as soon as 2012 ships, all 2008s are now out. It's when 2008 is actually out, and typically that's more than 10 years.
It's quite a while, yeah, absolutely. There's going to be two releases, so it could be quite a while before that turns into a boat anchor on your wall.
So will you update your MCM for 2012 when it comes along?
I tell you what, the lab exam, it's 6 hours, and it's probably the toughest SQL Server experience I've ever had.
Huh.
It's a really good simulation of your worst day ever as a consultant. And I, honest to God, I've talked with several of us who really love SQL Server. I would take that exam every month if I could. I'm a glutton for punishment, but it's so much fun. It's like the database equivalent of a video game.
Sure.
You want to do it again and see if you can beat your high score, see what new things the new level presents. So I'm sure that I'm going to be updating it, you know, as soon as the thing is available. I want to go bang on it and see, because plus two as a consultant, it's, you know, I get enough experience playing around with everybody's weirdo environments. I just had a call today with a client who's planning their 2012 go live migration. So I'll have the experience. It's just a matter of getting out there and doing the labs.
Interesting stuff. And by all means, you got to come back and tell us all about it when 2012 does come down.
Will do, will do. I look forward to it.
You bet. Brent, thanks so much for talking to us.
Always, always a pleasure, Richard. Thanks a lot.
And we'll talk to you next week on Run As Radio.